Hi, I'm Mark. Real alcoholic. Thanks for coming back for the rest of this. Yeah. You had enough of Brooklyn yet? Go out and drink some more. You'll go to Brooklyn. They're waiting for you. And that was a real powerful moment for me on that roof in Brooklyn, looking at that tree. I reconnected with the reality that there was a power in the universe greater than me, a reality I'd known as a little child. I mean, I was a little kid, I watched the sun come up, the moon come up, the rain, the birds. I mean, it was obvious. And I had totally turned my back on that power. And had spent many months in the land of the living dead. But when I saw it, when I had heard what I really had thought I'd heard in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I saw that tree that evening, that was the moment when I really was really done and really wanted to surrender. And when I went back in the rooms and I heard about powerless and I heard about unmanageable, it was such a relief. It was such a relief that it wasn't up to me anymore. And I remember I was on my way home from a meeting. I was walking past a store. And there was a bottle of whiskey in the window. And I looked at that bottle of whiskey, and I said, I know you now. I know you. You are the elixir of the living death. And I will never get in the ring with you again. I give up. You won. I'm through. And back then, I had just, you know, I heard 90 meetings in 90 days. And I had just enough alcoholic defiance left in me that I said, I'll show these AAs. I'll do 360 in 90. And I did. And it saved my life. But more importantly, it saved my soul. So I got a sponsor. This great big guy named Joe. He'd been a doctor once. But he was dealing drugs and the feds busted him. So they yanked his ticket, and he did 2 years of hard time in federal prison in Atlanta. He was a good sponsor for me. He didn't have a lot of sympathy for me, I'll tell you that. And, he'd say stuff to me like, hey, Mark, you're a powerful guy. I'm 15 minutes late for my golf date. Do you want to make the time go backwards so I get there on time? Or it'd be raining outside. You'd say, I forgot my umbrella. Would you stop the rain? And then, you know, we'd talk a little bit. He'd say, now, you know, wait a minute. I'd be telling him about something. He didn't like that too much. You know. He'd say, wait a minute. You're telling me something again. And he'd say, now, before you finish, I want you to tell me again. Explain to me again how. How many years did you go to school? 12 or 14? I said, well, probably around 14. After high school, right? I said, well, yeah, let's see, four years. Well, maybe 12, Joe. Oh, okay, 12 years after high school. You went to school, right? I said, yeah. I said, now would you please explain to me how you went to school for 12 years and you ended up walking down Flatbush Avenue with one shoe, only the collar of your shirt on, and a half a bottle of Thunderbird. Could you explain that to me again? And when you're done explaining that to me, then I'll listen to what you want to tell me. He was a real tough love guy. This Joe was a tough love guy. And over and over, no pain, no gain. This is gonna hurt. The steps, this is gonna be painful. But it's pain that's going somewhere. It's not like the pain you had before in jail, in the hospital, on the street. He said, this time, it's gonna go someplace. You're gonna get something out of it. It's the pain of healing. And he'd do stuff like, I remember one time I had this book, you know, and I was telling him about how I found God in this book. I said, Joe, I found God right here on this page. He said, you dumb ass. And he said, give me that book. He said, God's not in this book. And he says, he's in here. And he hit me in the chest. And that's where you have to look for him. He's inside of you. He says, God, I sponsor a lot of guys, but you're the dumbest son of a bitch. And, yeah, he said to me all the time. And the one I love that he always said to me, he go, Mark, if it makes sense to you, don't do it. Please. Yeah. And he took me through the steps, got me into service right away. You know, he says, I don't want you, you know, sponsoring anybody. He said, God. He says, you know, you get them a cup of coffee, you shake their hand, you say hello, you know, but don't be telling them about the program or drinking or nothing like that. And he says, you're a dumb son of a bitch. That's the way he treated me. But, it was exactly what I needed. And, you know, from that point on, I really dove into the program. And, you know, I started, you know, working the steps and trying to do service. And then things would come up. You know, then my brain damage started to heal. I started to be able to read, like I could read, you know, my warrants and my mail and my notices from the IRS, you know. And then I'd go to Joe and I'd say, Joe, you know, I got this problem with the, you know, with the IRS. And he'd say, wait, shut up. Work the steps, Mark. I don't want to hear about that shit. You work the steps. That'll be all right. Don't worry about it. Well, I got all these warrants, you know, and I was supposed to, you know, just work the steps, you know. And I said, well, Joe, I got all this child support, and I'm barely. He said, just work the steps. I don't want to hear that shit. I'm not interested in that. That doesn't. And he was right. All that stuff finally worked out. And, so I healed up slowly. You know, I went to a lot of meetings, did a lot of service, and was actually able to go back to work in the ER in Brooklyn. One little thing I kind of left out of my story is right before New York City, right before, as I was headed for the waterfall, right before the Thunderbird, the Mad Dog, and the Land of the Living Dead, right there, there was this girl. And I remember this like it was yesterday. She was looking at me, tears running down her face, and she's shaking her head, saying, you know, I love you, but I cannot watch this. I cannot watch you kill yourself like this. I just can't watch this. So I'm going to have to leave for a few days. That girl today is my wife. And she stuck with me through all those early days in AA. She came in and out. She stuck with me. And it's a miracle. That's one of many miracles. And from that point, from the tree and Joe, my sponsor, it's just been one miracle after another. Now, don't get me wrong. You know, life is difficult. I don't care who you are, where you come from. Life is difficult. There's been death. There's been sickness. There's been loss. There's been financial trouble. There's been all kinds of stuff. But hey, you know, it's not been okay, you know, but it's been okay. And it's just been one miracle after another. I had to go back to jail. I had to go to jail sober. That's a lot of fun. I really recommend that. 4 years sober, you go to jail, do your 9-step amends. That was a real blast. But it was very powerful. And I'll just tell you one little story about that. When I was in jail, I was looking for a big book. Couldn't find one. And I was sitting in the day room in jail, and I found a book stuck down in between the cushions. And I pulled it out, and it had a guy's name on it. Well, you're in jail. You know, whose is this? This is mine, you know. And they looked at the name and they said, oh, yeah. He got out yesterday, went back to his favorite bar, was doing cocaine and whiskey, and he fell over backwards and he's dead. So I guess you could keep his book, Mark. Stuff like that. Okay. Been restored to my profession. My kids, who I deserted when they were 7 and 11, they speak to me. They visit with me. And I don't have any warrants. My socks match. My breakfast stayed down. And I remember my name. And it's all because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in the room. You know, I could never have picked this book up and worked it myself. I had to have you folks. Without you guys, I'm just doing. So, you know, I don't care who you are, where you're from, what you've done, what you haven't done. You want what's in that book, it's yours for the asking. It's yours for the asking. And I've said many times before, those steps, if you work them the way the first 100 worked them, those steps will kill you. It will kill that old man who brought you here, that person who brought you here. They will kill that person. And then the ashes of that death will rise someone who's never been here before. And that's who you're looking at tonight. God bless you, each and every one. Thank you very much. Sure.
Did we do questions last week? Oh, okay.
Progress, not perfection.
Thanks. I'm Jim. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jim.
Thank you, Dr. Mark. I really appreciate your time and your wisdom that you bestowed on us. I have a question. My parents were alcoholics and addicts in some way, and I have 3 children, and I'm not quite sure how to help them or love them or protect them. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, again, you know, like I said earlier, there's no one's figured out the genetics of alcoholism or addiction. It's certainly not linear, like you know, take a black dog and a white dog, and you only have so many black puppies and so many white puppies. It just doesn't work like that. For the scientists in the room, it's not Mendelian at all, and no one's figured out the genetics. So there's no way of predicting, even if you draw a family tree, of what's going to happen. There are people that have enormous amounts of alcoholism, drug addiction on both sides, and they're not alcoholic or addicts. There's others who have no family history whatsoever, and they're addicts, alcoholics right out of the box. With young people, making them aware that it is a disease that can happen to almost anyone, and that there is help available. And to introduce them to it when they're young, impressionable. And so that, you know, things like addiction and alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous and the solution are real familiar to them, and they're real comfortable with that. You know, it's like, you know, grandma has high blood pressure, and, you know, your Aunt Mary has diabetes, but they're getting treatment and they're doing better. And, you know, your Uncle Ralph, he's an alcoholic and he had a rough time, but now he's doing better because he's going Alcoholics Anonymous. Blameless and honest as you can be. Yeah.
My name is Steve. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Steve.
Hi. I was going to ask you about the physical properties of alcoholism. You know, we were talking about one time that it being like jet fuel and that it reacts with the dopamine centers in your mind and stuff, and how it, once it gets in there and it starts that obsession, it starts taking care of, you know, I mean, it gets implanted in the mind. Does the mind, you know, itself, does it restore, does it get physically restored after a period of sobriety, or can you get that back, is my question. Because it seems like, you know, once the mind's been, like, you know, brain cells have been taken out, you know, because of this thing, you know, starting up, you know, does it get repaired? Does any of it ever come back? And
the brain damage gets repaired in better than 95% of us. These days, thank God, with earlier intervention, the wet brain is not as common as it used to be. And also, because of the ready availability of medically supervised detox, DTs, and some of the other complications are usually preventable, so we don't see the wet brain as much as we used to. But as a rule, most brains will rewire in 18 to 24 months. And the old, you know, we used to, you know, do shots and say, well, here goes another million cells, yeah, you know, and we'd laugh our ass off and on. But actually, that's not true. You do kill the cells, but our stem cells replace the nerve tissue. And you can, even people who've had a lot of us who do stimulants and alcohol get strokes and so forth. And even those we will wire around after time. So the good news is that most of the brain damage pretty much fully recovers. I mean, you might lose a few points in your IQ test, but you're going to be probably back better than you were. And in my case, I'm glad that brain was damaged and thrown away because it sure didn't do me any good. Yeah, Larry.
I'm Larry, alcoholic.
Yeah, Larry.
We've talked about this a little bit in the past, but I just thought about it again tonight when you were talking about your sponsor. You were telling your sponsor about your warrants, you know, you need to go to jail and you need to go take care of these warrants and you need to go to the doctors and you need to go to the psychiatrist. And over the years, and I've talked with Don about this too, but over the years, you know, I've worked with a few people and you get to a place where you're either ready to write the fourth step or it's time to do the ninth step or you're at the 12th step and it's time to go out and do the 12th step. And the guys you're working with, or the guys I've worked with, like, will just kind of stop or disappear, or, you know, they got to do psychiatry, they got to do family counseling, you know, they got to, you know, take care of the warmth, they got to work, you know, the job's more important, they got to go to school. I mean, ad infinitum. And it's frustrating, and it's sad, and anyway, maybe you can comment on that.
Yeah, that's one of the hard parts, but, you know, it's a 12-step program. The solution to the problem is to do 1 through 12 the way the first 100 did it, and then to carry that awakening to the alcoholic who still suffers. That's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the solution that produces recovery. And you have to apply the solution to the problem. The problem, say, is a fire. Well, the solution is to take the hose and point it at the base of the flame and turn on the liquid. Now, if you take that hose and stick it up your butt instead, the fire's going to go keep right on going, and you're not going to do so well either. And it's in the big book, you know, those who rush headlong at their financial problems, or those who, you know, we got to take care of this, we got to take care of the kids, we got to take care of the wife, we got to take care of the educators. So I don't know how this works, but you work those steps and you help others, and all that other stuff gets taken care of somehow. It's a mystery. But, I mean, I have not just heard that. I have seen that now thousands of times. People come into the program, they got a problem list, you know, 100 items long. And you see them 10 years later, and you say, well, how did that turn out? And they go, I don't remember that. They don't even remember what their problem is. They're all, you know, things have changed. Things. Powerful stuff, yeah.
I'm Mark, Jeff, alcoholic.
Yeah.
This is kind of a little bit of what Larry asked. And being a sponsee or even a sponsor, how quick should you originally first go through the 12 steps? I mean, I see some people that have been in the program for 3, 4, 5 years and they're still on step 3. And then, you know, I know back in when the program first started, didn't they go through the 12 steps pretty quickly, like the first couple of months or maybe even a couple of weeks? Or is it just based on the person themselves and how eager they are to get this, or how much time they have, or, you know, can you comment on that?
I think you work the steps as quickly and diligently as whatever your physical situation allows. Effie came to see Bill Wilson. What, about 2-3 weeks they had him in the hospital? We got him in detox, got him cleaned up because he was impending DT. So that was all not quite a month. And then he worked steps with Effie in about 2 or 3 days. And a powerful spiritual experience. He's fine now. Yeah, maybe you find it now. So, you just start working them, and you do them as quickly as the situation allows. You apply the solution to the problem. If you come to the ER with a gunshot wound to the chest, what are we going to do? Tell you to take a seat, read a magazine until you think you feel ready to have us operate on you? Boy, some lawyer would love that, wouldn't he? Yeah, what'd you do, doctor? Oh, I told him to have a seat in the waiting room. Tell me when he was ready, you know. Sure, you know, you've got to take... If you get a prescription, you get some medicine, you're going to... What, you're going to get ready to take the medicine? We get this idea that we're going to sit around in AA, drink coffee, eat cookies, play softball, go to the dance until we, till we're well enough to take the steps. No, you do the steps and get well. And then you play softball, eat cookies, drink coffee, and help others. You know? You apply the solution to the problem. Yeah.
Hi, my name's James, and I'm an addict, and I got two questions for you tonight.
Hi, James.
It's not to say that drinking in the past hasn't been a major problem for me. It has. But my first question is to you is that I've drinking a lot in my past, but you drank so much that your drinking career makes my drinking career look like Bambi. So my question to you tonight is how the hell did you manage to survive? And then my second question is I'm not sure that I fully understand the concepts behind the physical allergy and the mental obsession. Do you think you could explain that in a little further detail?
Well, for your first question, how did I have no idea how I feel. It's a miracle. I don't deserve to be here tonight. I shouldn't be here. It's, you know, I mean, like, I used to say to Joe, that's not fair. And he'd say, kiss my ass. Life's not fair. Fair? You should be dead or locked up. What are you doing in Brooklyn? Right? I don't deserve to be here. If life was fair, I should be dead or locked up for 1,000 years. But I'm here tonight. That's a miracle. The Christians call that grace. Undeserved mercy and love. Why this higher power had mercy? I have no idea. I sure don't deserve it. But he, she, it did. And I'm mighty grateful. The allergy is that stuff makes you feel wonderful and you want more. That's the allergy. And although you know it's dangerous and bad for you, your brain tells you it's okay and you can go ahead and have it, no matter what kind of trouble you've been in. So you can't use and you can't quit. You're powerless and you're hopeless. And unless you do what's in this book, you're going down. You're going down. And I don't necessarily mean die. I mean misery. Spend some time in that doctor's opinion. Right there. Yeah.
Hi, Mark. I'm Don. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Don.
I have two questions for you. One is, during my last stay in the county hospital, the doctor took me off of all of my antidepressants. Of course, I was on like six of them about the time I got there. I've been lying to doctors for so many years. And he told me on the way out, he said, Don, remember, you've got to be a hell of a lot more depressed than normal people if you ever think you need to be on antidepressants. So I have the unfortunate ability to get in front of a doctor and say certain things. As my sponsor reminds me, I'm not just dishonest. I'm a goddamn liar about lots of things I do. So that's my first question. How do I really know if I need to be on antidepressants? And my second question was, I heard you speak before about how a lot of people talk about applying a fourth step to daily challenges in their life, but I've heard you talk about how you kind of run through 1 through 12, and you can do it very quickly in your head, and I'd like to hear that again.
Okay. Before we do your first question, how, you know, if you're going to be a good practicing alcoholic drug addict, you better be a goddamn good liar. Or you won't get, you know, you get locked up before lunch. Even a wino like me knows that. Yeah, antidepressants, you know, that. Now, the antidepressants are wonderful drugs. They have revolutionized the science of psychiatry, if you'll allow me to call it a science. Because in a lot of cases, it's an art form. And I have great admiration for psychiatrists. I mean, can you imagine the shit they put up from us? Jesus. God. And they've never turned their backs on us. All these decades, from way back, Carl Jung and Sigmund Freud, they've never really turned their backs on us. But antidepressants are very powerful drugs. They are mind-altering drugs, and they are addictive. Okay? Bottom line. And some people need them. I'm not a psychiatrist, but the general rule is that unless you are bipolar, schizoaffective, or have had a major depressive episode that is hospitalized or psychotic, and the use of antidepressants in your case being alcoholics and drug addicts, can be risky. And it's a decision that you and your doctor have to make together with a lot of thought and a lot of care. Can't lay down any hard and fast rules, but if your family doctor just goes, "Oh, well, what's the matter, Jack? You're not feeling so good today?" And you say, "Yeah, man, I tried to wax my car and it didn't turn out right. Now I'm feeling kind of down. Well, here, Jack, here, why don't you take some Prozac and see me in a month?" "Oh, well, thank you very much, Look, Ma, look what the doctor gave me." No, wrong, stop, wait a minute. It's a mind-altering drug. It's addictive. What are you doing with it, Mr. Drug Addict Alcoholic? Huh? You're going to go polish your car with it? You're going to take them all today, And like he says, you take one and you say, "Well, this really isn't working so good. So maybe if I go to my other doctor, I can get a faster." I heard that, some of them make you go faster. And then before you know it, you're taking 10 different. Then you got to take something to sleep. And then you got to take something. So, I don't have to tell you guys. So, in normal people who don't have our illness, the antidepressants have a far wider indication and a wider use and applicability. But in us, we have to be extremely careful. Now, the other side of that coin is there are alcoholics and drug addicts who absolutely have to take those medications. And you have somebody with schizoaffective disorder or bipolar disorder, and they come in the program, and they're taking those medicines, and you're their sponsor, and you say, "I don't sponsor you unless you take nothing." And all of a sudden, the guy has a psychotic episode, and he kills his whole family. Well, way to go, Great job, So certain people who carry a major psychiatric diagnosis absolutely have to take their medicine. So we have to be careful. And then your second question, if you practice a little bit, you should be able to do the steps in your head in a few minutes, okay? Example, I have a financial problem. One, I know I am powerless over that problem, and it is not manageable by me. Two, but I believe that the power that created me and made me sober, working in the universe and in my heart and mind, will solve that problem. So three, I'm going to make a decision to turn that problem over to the power that created me. I'm going to turn over my thoughts and my actions. How am I going to do that? Four, where have I been selfish, self-seeking, frightened, and afraid? I'm going to discuss that with somebody else as soon as I can. I'm going to identify those shortcomings that are around this problem. Six, I'm going to be ready for those shortcomings to be removed. I'm going to get down on my knees and humbly ask that those things be taken from me. If I've hurt anyone in the process of facing this problem, I'm going to make my amends as soon as I can. That's 1 through 9. 1 through 9 on a daily episodic basis is the 10th step. Continue. 10 leads to 11. Now what do you want me to do, God? Prayer and meditation, ask for guidance. That should bring an awakening, and I'm going to go help another alcoholic. Whether you break a shoelace or your loved one's dying, 1 through 12. The misconception you run into is someone says, you know, I got this problem with so-and-so. You think I should work a third step on that? Well, this is not a one-step program. This is a 12-step program. So whatever you're facing, it's 1 through 12. Because half measures avail us nothing. Okay.
Yeah, Doc, thanks for your share tonight. It was really nice. My question is, I'm Don, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Don.
My question to you, Doc, is how long were you abstained before you started working the steps?
How long do you what?
Did you abstain before you started working the steps? Abstained.
I'm not quite. How long did that happen to me, or are you asking for a general rule? How long did it take me before I took the first step? Yeah. That must have taken a couple of weeks before I consciously said, I give up. Yeah, that took a couple of weeks. You're welcome.
Hey, Mark, if you was to do surgery on somebody and the person was up front with you and said that they were an alcoholic and a drug addict and they have the allergy and obsession, what would you prescribe to them as a painkiller or something for the pain?
Well, a lot depends on what kind of surgery you're talking about, but for the most part, most surgical procedures, they'll get intravenous narcotics in the hospital, and then maybe they'll get 12 or 24 hours of oral narcotics right before they go home, and then maybe anywhere from 1 to 5 days of narcotics during their post-op period and their recovery with the provision that those go-home narcotics go home with someone else, not the addict or the alcoholic. If there's nobody, a lot of surgeons that I know take this very seriously, and if there is not a responsible adult who will take that medication and administer it to the addict or alcoholic, they will not prescribe unless the visiting nurse is involved. And they will ask the addict or alcoholic to absorb that cost because they don't want to see them do that. So usually, most surgical procedures these days, by day 4 or 5, they don't need narcotics anymore. The alcoholic addict, we would taper him or her, but As always, the goal is to be drug-free. Very short interval.
Yeah. Hi, I'm George, alcoholic. I have a question about character defects. And I have to first start by saying that I think of myself as a very intelligent person. And I have it both ways, books and street smarts, right? Common sense, nothing can ever surprise me. I see all the outcomes of absolutely any scenario. Past couple of years, hanging out with Donna and Don and doing this work, and like letting God in my life, having this spiritual experience, having many spiritual experiences, all of a sudden, things start happening that I was blindsided on, right? That I had no idea, right? My God obviously is smarter than me, okay? So, however, when these things happen, it surprises me. And because I really didn't see them coming, and then when I talk about them, they just seem really simple. So what's happened lately is that, and it involves character defects, is that I know it's only been like a couple years, right, that I've been not sober, but really doing this work from the book and having these actual spiritual experiences. And I really thought, there's this one character defect that I have that I can trace back to when I was 7. Right? And I'm thinking, okay, I'm doing this work, right? That character defect should not be showing up in my life anymore. Okay? I have more sponsees than I've ever had. I'm busy in AA. I'm on fire, right? And then all of a sudden comes this character defect, and there I am again, fallen, right? And I just can't even believe it, right? And I'm thinking, I've done everything right. My alcoholic mind says, man, this program doesn't work, because what else could I have done? Prayed about it every day, done this, done that, and still I fall prey to this godforsaken character defect that I've had since I was 7.
Welcome to the human race. St. Paul, who was one of the apostles, he had the experience on the road to Damascus where the light came down and blinded him. And then, he had visions and he was filled with all. He had a pretty powerful spiritual experience. He was blind for 3 days afterwards. And he has a saying. He says, I know what I do is wrong. I hate what I do, and I do it anyway. We are broken. We are damaged goods. I mean, you are born stained with pride, anger, greed, envy, sloth, gluttony, and lust. And now you want to be perfect? It doesn't work out. But if we admit it, then we let the power that created us into our lives. God enters through the wound. He comes in through the brokenness. So I say, yeah, I'm a bum. I'm still a bum. And only His power and mercy gets me here tonight. I will never be able to fix myself. And you know what? It's okay. We don't have to be perfect. And, I've heard this so many times. I'm working a great program. I'm sponsoring 25 people. I'm doing a book study. And you know what she did to me? And you know what happened? Yeah. Hello? Just because you work the program perfectly doesn't mean you become God. It doesn't work like that. And as my other sponsor always says, live in the mystery. I know for sure one thing. For sure. I know that I don't know. So finally, I understand. I'm broken. I'm fallen. It's not okay, but it's fine. Because this power that made me sober in Brooklyn is inside of me. With me every heartbeat.
Good evening, Dr. Marks. My name is Wayne. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Wayne.
For those of us who are just beginning to work the steps, is there any one particular story in the Big Book that you would recommend that would, give us more foundation as far as our beginning?
Well, I need it. We all have our favorite stories, but, I think the stories themselves are really, really powerful, every single one of them. And I wouldn't miss a single story. But I would say off the beginning, if you pay a lot of attention, the best attention you can, to the doctor's opinion and Bill's story, that contains the entire program of Alcoholics Anonymous in those two chapters. Now, that doesn't mean you read those two chapters and that's it. That's just the starting point. But you can experience the whole program. You know, get the problem and the method of recovery from Dr. Silkworth and the doctor's opinion. You go with Bill to the land of the living dead, and on page 13 you can watch him work his death and get better. That's a good starting point. All right. Good. Okay.